True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery, Ty Grabbers. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Faith Hedgepeth was just 19 years old when she was violently murdered in her off-campus apartment. Faith was popular and pretty outgoing, with plans to become a pediatrician and serve the Haliwa Saponi Native American tribe. She was studying at the University of Chapel Hill in North Carolina and living with her best friend. Then, on September 7th, 2012, a 911 call came in from Faith's roommate. The call would become the subject of much speculation, along with a note left at the scene, DNA evidence, and an unusual murder weapon. Join us at the quiet end for Unsolved, the Murder of Faith Hedgepeth. It's been 8 years since Connie Hedgepeth lost her baby girl. It doesn't seem like too much for her to ask to learn why Faith was killed or to see her killer go to trial. Today we're going to talk about where the investigation is at, what is needed to make an arrest, and where all the circumstantial evidence is pointing. And Dick has brought us a beer as usual.
I have. This is Black Angel from Wicked Weed Brewing in Asheville, North Carolina. Just a side note, at least 35 years ago, Asheville was one of my favorite cities to visit. My first practice was in Columbia, South Carolina, and I had a good friend from medical school who was serving in the Indian Health Service in Cherokee. So we'd visit back and forth, and oftentimes we'd head into Asheville for a little partying and stuff. And I just love that city. I have no idea what it's like now. I hope it's still the same. But it was just a really, really fun place to visit. So, on to the beer. Sorry for the digression.
No, that's fine.
Black Angel's a wild ale, just for Jill.
Thank you.
It's a black beer with a light tan head. Great aroma, sour cherry, chocolate, some red wine and oak. And the taste is even better. Sour cherry to begin with, a little lemony flavor, chocolate, wooden, and red wine. Now, it's supposed to be aged in bourbon barrels, but it has more of a red wine taste to me. It's a tart and crisp wild ale. Very, very good. Good brewery, good beer.
Yes, I must admit I cheated and I drank some yesterday, and it's really excellent.
Oh, well, that's why the bottle disappeared. Okay.
All right, let's open it up. Why don't you follow me over to the quiet end, and we'll drink it with our dogs.
I will.
Okay.
Okay. Faith Danielle Hedgepeth was a member of the Haliwa Saponi Native American tribe. She was born in 1992 in Warren County, North Carolina. She was the fourth child and second daughter of Roland and Connie Hedgepeth. Connie has said her daughter was named Faith because that's what she needed to have, with four children and a deeply drug-addicted husband. Now, Faith's parents divorced when she was about a year old, and Faith was raised by her mother and her older sister, Rolanda, in Hollister and Warrenton, North Carolina. Connie called Faith her godsend baby, who kept her life anchored.
Yeah, it wasn't an easy life at all.
No, it certainly wasn't.
But they certainly did see Faith as a real blessing in their lives.
Yes, they did.
And she was really an active child and always had a lot of interests. She was an honor student in high school and was involved in many extracurricular activities. Actually, she was a cheerleader. And that's not easy, actually. That's a lot of work.
It certainly is.
She did well enough in school to be offered a scholarship to the University of North Carolina, which is a really good school.
Well, you could even say an elite school. It's a pretty big time.
And she hoped to be the first member of her family to earn a college degree. So she came from humble beginnings and had big dreams.
Yeah, her father had attended UNC, but had to drop out after a year. And when Faith entered school, she had thoughts of becoming a pediatrician or maybe a teacher.
Right, and not only are these difficult subjects and things you have to work hard at, but they're both very helping professions.
Yes, they are.
Absolutely. I mean, you don't become either of those just to get rich or run a business or, you know, to run people into the ground.
No. No, that was good.
No, seriously, though, those are things they want to help kids. What can be nicer?
Exactly. She did pretty well academically in her freshman year. She ended up having some difficulty with biology classes. So sophomore year, she took part-time classes, and then in the spring, she took the semester off, hoping to re-enter college life that fall. She stayed in Chapel Hill over the summer, taking some classes to kind of reacclimate herself and to stay in her class.
Well, sure, because she was very determined to go back. She wasn't going to leave college for good at all.
No, she wasn't. She had told friends that she was thinking of changing her major from biology to public health because she had seen the disparities in healthcare access in her own community and wanted to work to remedy them.
Now, see, that makes sense to me because I feel like when you get out of high school and you go to college, you don't really know what you want. You have a general idea, and she's thinking, I want to help my community. I want to help children. I'll be a teacher or a pediatrician. But then when you learn more about things, she kind of found something more specific where she felt like she could help her community. Because, you know, healthcare for Indigenous peoples is just horrible in this country.
Certainly is. So she was looking to be a help to humanity, basically.
Sure. And she had stayed in Chapel Hill over the summer of 2012, taking a couple classes. She lived in an apartment off campus with a really close friend, Karina Rosario, and Karina's boyfriend, Eric Tokoi Jones. So once her financial aid for the fall became available, Faith planned to live in an apartment with another friend of hers, Victoria Chavez.
Yeah, she had known Victoria since she started school, and they were very good friends. Not that she disliked Karina, but Karina lived in a one-bedroom apartment.
Well, yeah, didn't Karina kind of have some issues going on in her own life?
She did.
Karina and her boyfriend Eric had kind of a rocky relationship, which was actually marked by domestic violence.
It was.
And Karina ended their relationship in July of 2012. And that's when Eric moved out because he'd been living with her. And he tried twice to break into the apartment after that. So the second time, Karina had changed the locks. And after the second time, Faith had encouraged her friend to go to the courthouse and get a protective order against Eric. Of course, Eric didn't like this. And what he did is he blamed Faith for the breakup and for influencing his girlfriend.
Yeah, in fact, he was conversing on the phone with a person, and he threatened to kill Faith if he wasn't able to get back with Karina.
So that's scary.
Just a bit, right?
So the last day of Faith's life, September 6th, 2012, was really like any other day that summer. Faith attended class. She saw friends, and she talked to her family. Then a little before 6 p.m., Faith went to a sorority rush event at a local apartment building. She hoped to be accepted to Alpha Pi Omega, a Native American sorority at UNC. And her friend Victoria also attended there.
Yeah, now Faith left the event a little after 7, telling people she was working on a paper and she needed to go to the library to work on it. The paper was about the history of her tribe. And she met her roommate Karina at the library. I'm not sure. I think they were working on the paper together. But at least they were there at the library working. And while she was there, she got a text from her father, who was having some sort of crisis. We're not really sure what it was, but it was a crisis at that time. And her last text to him was, "Just have faith, Daddy. I promise it'll work out." Then around 9 p.m., she texted Victoria, and they talked for a while and talked about joining the sorority. So it was pretty evident that if they were offered to join, they were going to join.
That was definitely their plan. That's what they wanted. So shortly after that, Faith did leave the library and return to her apartment. Then around midnight, Faith and Karina decided to go to The Thrill, which is a local dance club.
Isn't youth nice? It's midnight. Let's go out and party and dance for a while.
I know. It's been a long time since I did anything like that.
I'd be comatose for half an hour to 2 hours before that, without even going out.
Right. Yeah, but you spent many years, you know, getting up in the middle of the night, going into the hospital and everything, so.
Yeah,
you know what it's like, yeah. And then having to work the whole day, so. But of course, youth, yes, you can do that and really not miss a beat, usually.
No. What's the old saying? Youth is wasted on the young or something like that?
It sure is, right? If you think about it. But anyway, they met up with some guys and they danced for about an hour and a half. Then Karina said she felt sick, and she and Faith left the club. This was around 2 a.m. So security cameras at The Thrill showed Faith and Karina leaving at 2:06 a.m.
Yeah, and actually, they didn't quite leave together. I mean, they were close enough, but Karina left with a couple friends first, and then closely followed by Faith with some guy. They left those people and drove back together to the apartment.
Well, and Karina wasn't feeling well. She was sick to her stomach, right?
Yeah, she said she was feeling ill.
So they got back to the apartment at 2:30, and Karina was throwing up, and Faith was actually helping her out, as far as we know.
Yeah, there's some issue about whether Karina had had a little bit too much alcohol, although The Thrill at that hour was alcohol-free. It was just to allow underage kids to dance. So I don't know. She may have gotten alcohol from someplace. Maybe she was served at The Thrill. Maybe she smuggled some in or what. But apparently she was sick to her stomach because of alcohol.
So how old was she? She was the same age as Faith?
Yeah, 19, 20.
Okay. Well, a woman who lived below them in the apartment complex said she heard three thumping noises around 3 a.m. And the way she described them was it sounded like a bag being dropped onto the floor, like a heavy bag.
Yeah, thump.
Yeah, so who knows? But it's fairly significant as we go through things.
It might be, absolutely.
So Faith texted some people over the next half an hour or so. And one of these texts at 3:40 a.m. was to an off-and-on boyfriend of Karina's, and his name is Brandon Edwards.
Yeah, now again, this is Faith texting, supposedly. And the text said, "Hey, B, can you come over here, please? Rosario needs you more. Aha, you know. Please let her know you care." Then this was followed a couple minutes later with another text from Faith's phone with the word "than" only being texted. So the idea is that "then" was taking the place of "aha."
Oh, in so the initial it's just text. Like a typo thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So Brandon had even slept on a couch in the apartment the night before Faith's murder. And at 3:52, there was a text from Faith's phone to Ty McNeil, another former boyfriend.
Former boyfriend of Faith.
Okay, but still another former boyfriend of one of the girls.
Yes.
Okay. So the text said, "I know you're probably sleeping, but I wanted to let you know that not a day goes by that you don't cross my mind, and I know that it will be like this for the rest of my life. Sorry for being in my feelings, but hey, we all have feelings."
Yeah, now just one quick thing. I mean, we'll get around to this some more later. But Faith's father says that's not Faith's writing because she was a real stickler for punctuation, and she wrote "your," Y-O-U-R-E, without the apostrophe. So for that reason, he thinks it wasn't her writing it. And we'll see why that idea comes up later.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I think that's a bit of a stretch. Even if you're a stickler, it's like the middle of the night, you've been drinking, and all it is one apostrophe.
Right.
I mean, if it was Y-O-U-R, that would be upsetting to me.
Yeah.
That would be much worse.
And there is also, when she says "don't," she spells that correctly.
Uh-huh. She has the apostrophe in that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I don't know. We'll see.
So, there's evidence that McNeil wanted to be with Faith again and be her boyfriend. He texted her the day before she died, asking if she wanted to get together that night, and she didn't respond.
Yeah, she and McNeil had dated when she was a freshman, and maybe even into some of her sophomore year. And they broke up because Faith was still seeing her high school sweetheart. She couldn't commit one way or the other. And she was seeing both McNeil and the kid from high school.
Yeah, but there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on Ty McNeil.
There is.
He was questioned by police and wasn't considered a suspect when his DNA didn't match DNA that was found at the crime scene. But Faith's family questioned whether Faith had even sent that text, as you said.
Yeah, and Faith's friends also reported that there perhaps was some instances of McNeil being physical with Faith.
Violent.
Right.
I'm just clarifying, because physical could mean sexual.
Yeah, you're right.
But yes, there were quite a few instances of that kind of thing being mentioned.
Right. And then there was a final text to Faith's phone that came around 4:16 in the morning, and this was from Edwards. And he was asking in his text, "Who's this?" Like he didn't know who had been texting him.
Okay. So Edwards, Brandon Edwards, was an off and on boyfriend of Karina.
Right.
Just clarifying that. Okay.
And Ty McNeil was an on and off boyfriend of Faith.
Okay. So records from Karina's phone showed that she'd been trying to contact Brandon at about the same time. And when he didn't answer, Karina called Jordan McCrary. That's a UNC soccer player who she knew. And around 4:30 a.m., Karina was picked up by McCrary. She said she thought Faith was asleep in her room and she left the apartment door unlocked. So this to me is strange.
It is. Why would you leave a sleeping roommate with the door unlocked?
Well, and why would you leave if you didn't feel good? Why would you be leaving an hour later?
That's true, too.
Although, like you said, you know, you're young. I guess stuff like that happens. But yeah. Still, it's a little weird to me that she was throwing up, and then she decided to go out like an hour later.
Yeah, and the implication was that it was kind of a booty call that she was going out on. But anyway, I don't know why you would leave the door unlocked. The story Karina said was that there was only one key to the apartment, and she didn't want Faith waking up with the door locked and no key. She wakes up, no key. She calls Karina, says, "You have the key? Yes. Come back and lock the door. I just left."
So Karina and Jordan ended up at the home of a friend of theirs. And she said she was there until mid-morning. And then she began to call Faith because she wanted to arrange for a ride home. And when she couldn't get a hold of Faith, she called another friend. And this friend was Marisol Rangel. And she picked her up and drove Karina home to the apartment where Faith was at.
Right.
A lot of people here to remember.
So Karina and Marisol arrived around 11 in the morning at the apartment. They walked in, called for Faith, not answered. Faith's car was in the parking lot down below. It was an upstairs apartment. And then they found Faith in her bedroom, actually Karina's bedroom, cold and unresponsive. So there's Faith. She's lying face up. Her head was partway off the bed. Her face was bloodied and disfigured.
Yeah, this was just a brutal crime scene. This wasn't just somebody passed out and cold.
No, this was a bloody scene. The bedroom was full of blood spatter.
Right. Large pool of blood under her head. She had a black t-shirt, but it was pulled up and she was nude from the waist down. So it appeared that she may have been sexually assaulted. And semen was collected and sent for DNA analysis.
Yeah, and I think we'll discuss this later, but we never know where the semen was collected from, whether it was from her vagina, her rectum, or on her body.
So the police haven't released that?
Nope.
But we do know that she'd been bludgeoned with something pretty heavy, a blunt object. And there was a Bacardi rum bottle with tissue and blood on it. So they thought that was the murder weapon, and I think they stuck with that theory.
Yes, they did, that she was beaten with a rum bottle.
Well, and one really strange thing was that on the bed, there was a white paper bag, like the kind you might get a hamburger from a takeout place in. And it had no blood on it at all. And on the bag was written, "I'm not stupid, bitch. Jealous."
Yeah, very interesting finding. So it was apparent that the bag had been placed there after the fact because there was no blood spatter or anything on it.
Right, exactly. And it's just weird. I'm not even sure what that means, but it certainly sounds like something a woman would write to me.
Yeah, you're right.
It just does. But Eric Tekoi Jones, Karina's former boyfriend, was a prime suspect early on because police knew about the restraining order against him and also about the threat he had made against Faith, remember?
Right.
He'd been mad at her for helping Karina get a restraining order against him, and he felt like Faith was coming between the two of them.
He certainly did. And even though he got kicked out of the apartment, he was still living in the same apartment complex.
So he had some easy access there.
Right. So he looks good right at the start.
Sure.
And the other interesting thing that makes you think it could have been Eric is the day before Faith was killed, Jones had texted a friend seeking forgiveness, and I quote, "for what I am about to do." Then 3 days after the murder, Jones changed his Facebook page to, quote, "Dear Lord, forgive me for all of my sins and the sins I may commit today. Protect me from the girls who don't deserve me and the ones who wish me dead today."
Yeah, so this Eric Tekoi Jones was kind of a weirdo.
Very weird.
And violent. We know that he was violent, right?
We do.
He broke into the apartment.
Twice.
Yes.
And the interesting thing, since he was a resident of the same complex, he was interviewed on TV. And here's this guy who really dislikes Faith talking about how much he loved her and what a great person she was and that he hopes the person who's responsible burns in hell. And it's just weird stuff.
Well, yes, but you know, if someone's murdered, it would also look really bad to say, "oh, she was such a bitch, I'm glad." I mean, kind of normal to say good things about a victim.
Sure. Plus, it's also, I mean, if he was, a lot of times the perpetrator hides himself by trying to help the police and offer advice and stuff.
Well, sure. Yeah, I could see that.
So Jones was interviewed, and eventually, after some reluctance, did give a DNA sample. But it didn't match the DNA that had been collected at the scene of the murder. Also, DNA from Brandon Edwards, Jordan McCrary, Ty McNeil, and other men who had interacted with Faith at the Thrill also did not match the presumptive killer's DNA.
So it's really a mystery.
Yeah, I think they ended up getting DNA on like 700 men, and obviously none of them matched.
So, I mean, it is possible this was a random person.
Sure.
But I imagine they investigated everyone that she'd seen at the Thrill.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they didn't get DNA on everybody.
Yeah, so it is possible that it was somebody that we don't know about.
There is that possibility, but you're going to see why that would be extremely unlikely.
Yeah, and there's a lot of odd behavior by a lot of these characters. But the DNA thing just is mind-boggling, really.
Yeah.
But within a few days of Faith's murder, the records were sealed. The only reports made public was one on the day her body was found, which said the murder had not been a random crime. And one 4 months later, which said the DNA at the scene indicated it was a male suspect. Well, duh. Every 45 to 60 days, a Superior Court judge resealed the documents. And that had been requested by the town of Chapel Hill.
Yeah, they kind of did that routinely, which ran contrary to other murder investigations or other crime investigations they had been doing. Every other time, records were made more public. But not this one.
And we don't know why?
We don't know why.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess the theory is that it was to hold some things, some evidence closer to their vests so that when they did find a viable suspect, they had something to ask him about.
I could see that, yeah.
But they did this every couple months. The records were resealed and never made public.
1 year after the murder, the Chapel Hill Police Department requested the assistance of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, but still they kept the documents sealed. Then 6 months later, the Daily Tar Heel, the Raleigh News and Observer, and Capital Broadcasting Company went to court, and they were trying to unseal these records. They wanted more information. I mean, there were a lot of people taking on this do-it-yourself, sleuths, the media. A lot of people want to solve this murder.
They sure do. But the records are sealed. They don't have anything.
But they did have a hearing, right?
They did. They went to court in an attempt to unseal the records. During the hearing, the district attorney gave a report on the investigation, and he basically said, "Nah, we don't have anything new to report."
Wow.
In the end, the records stayed sealed.
This is just such a strange case, isn't it?
It sure is.
And of course, that decision was met with a lot of skepticism. One reporter, Chelsea Delaney, suggested that the seal was to hide errors by the Chapel Hill Police Department. So that's interesting. That's possible, right? That could happen.
Sure.
It's happened before.
And Delaney wrote for the Daily Tar Heel, the university newspaper, and she did investigation on her own. It was very interesting. So she was told by residents of the apartment complex that the police did cordon off the four-unit block where Faith's apartment was. They only searched Faith's apartment, no one else's. They didn't search the woods behind the buildings, and they didn't appear to have talked to people in the area or to canvass the area. Not only that, Faith's car had been left unsecured for a length of time.
So you know what? There's probably a good reason why this hasn't been solved, because it seems like the investigation was not the best.
No, it doesn't appear that way. The other thing, Delaney spoke with the owner of a towing company. This guy had a contract with The Thrill for their parking area, so he would take cars away that were parked illegally or after hours, that type of thing.
Right, yeah.
So this guy, towing company owner, said he spoke with the police when they wanted to look at his film from his security cameras.
Well, that would be crucial, I would think.
Yeah, but guess when they did this? It was a year and a half after Faith's murder. So any data that might have been there had long ago been recorded over.
Wow. So that's really bad. That's so important. I mean, I think that there's probably a connection with what went on at The Thrill, because we have more information on that as well, correct?
Correct.
So residents of the apartment complex also told Delaney that the officers from the State Bureau of Investigation were way more skilled in their interview techniques than the Chapel Hill police. So what does that mean?
Well, again, the implication is that the Chapel Hill police didn't do an adequate investigation.
I mean, from everything we've heard, it just seems kind of half-assed.
It does. So looking into that, the Chapel Hill Police Department investigates, on the average, one murder per year. Okay,
significant, sure.
And there are 10 officers in the investigation unit. But of these 10, only 7 are assigned to cases. The other 3 are in the office doing work. And even with the people that are assigned to cases, you know there's other cases being investigated, so it's not like you're just doing that one case.
Well, yeah. So they're not just focused on the one case.
Right.
So with one murder per year, the clearance rate wasn't 100%, was it?
No. Now, the spokesman for the police department is named Josh Essamore, and he said the lack of manpower was one reason that they called in the state police or the Bureau of Investigation.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a good thing that they did.
Yeah, well, they know how to do that more than the local police.
Well, that's putting it mildly, yes.
And Essamore went on to say that the police officers generally had at least 5 years' experience before they could even apply to the investigative unit. And at the time Faith was killed, the average investigator had 16 years of experience.
Hmm.
So that sounds okay. And they have many opportunities for extra training. So that sounds better than the actual performance.
It sure does.
And then Messimore's final statement in talking with Delaney was that he thought that Faith's homicide would be solved.
Yeah, but we're looking at what, like 8 years now?
It'll be 8 years in September. Yep.
So records were unsealed by a court order in July of 2014. That's about 2 years after Faith's murder. But they were heavily redacted. Still, the records did generate a lot of renewed interest in the murder and in solving it. 2 months after that, the autopsy report was released. And what did we learn from the autopsy report? I know you were going over that.
Well, it confirmed what was already known, that Faith had died from blunt force trauma to her head from the bottle. Cuts and bruises and blood under her fingernails indicated that she struggled. This semen DNA matched other male DNA found at the scene. So, and when they say at the scene, I don't know, again, this is a one-bedroom apartment, so it's got a kitchen sitting room and a bedroom with a bathroom. That's it.
But it looked like she was actually murdered in the room she was found in, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't know where else they found the male DNA in the apartment.
So there were some pieces of evidence that really did need a closer look.
Oh, yeah. Now, here's where it's going to get interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that 911 call. Let's do that, because I found that really suspicious.
You really went off on that.
It was a real what-the-fuck moment for me.
Yeah, and obviously many people consider it pretty suspicious.
Yeah, I'm not alone, that's for sure.
No. So Karina first said she had just returned to her apartment. So the 911 operator says, "What's your emergency?" She says, "I just got home."
Yeah, who does that?
So it was like she was trying to provide an alibi for herself.
Well, it was weird because it seems like the first thing you would say is, "Come now, help. You know, my roommate is covered in blood. She's been murdered.
Just got home. My roommate's in bed with blood all over the place. I need people now."
Right. But first of all, I don't think she needed to say, "I just got home." That's one thing.
Nope.
And she never once mentioned Faith by name. She just referred to her as her roommate, which to me seemed like a way to kind of distance herself because these girls were like sisters. These were close friends.
They were supposed to be.
Yeah. Everyone who knew them said they were very close friends.
Right.
So you say your roommate, that's a little weird to me too.
Well, it's a little impersonal, right?
And each of these individual things alone aren't that suspicious, but when you put them together, I find it really strange.
Yeah. Now, Karina also, in this conversation with a 911 operator, seemed pretty reluctant to touch Faith's body. The operator's trying to get her to check her and see if she was breathing and if she had a pulse. Have you tried CPR? And she was kind of, ooh, no.
Yeah. And that I could almost go either way on because it had to be shocking and she probably could tell she was dead or have a pretty good idea.
Right.
So that I could go either way on. But why didn't she even mention that Marisol was with her?
Right. I mean, the 911 operator had no idea that there was a second person there.
So I found that kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, if you're there and you met with this horrific scene, wouldn't you figure both women would be going nuts?
Well, yes.
But the 911 operator only heard Karina's voice.
Right. You know, there just seemed to be a lot of information that the 911 operator wasn't asking for, that Karina was giving. I mean, she said it appeared someone had entered the apartment. And Tom Gasparoli, a reporter who covered this case, even raised the possibility that maybe it was Marisol and not Karina who made that 911 call.
Yeah, there's that possibility, although I'm not sure what difference that makes.
That's true. And from interviews that we did see with Marisol, she seemed very genuine to me.
She did.
I found her very believable.
We've said many times before, there really isn't any textbook about how you're supposed to react when you discover a dead body.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you're right about that. I don't know how I would react. But I think just the first thing her saying, "I just got home," was really weird.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, these are all interpretations of how different people thought Karina should have been acting.
But she didn't say, "My roommate's covered in blood," either. All she said is, "My roommate's unconscious."
Yep.
Well, unconscious is very different from bludgeoned to death.
Yes, it is. But that's the call.
Yeah.
Then let's talk about the note that was left at the scene.
Another very strange thing, yes.
So on this white paper bag were the words, "I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous." Now the bag is the type that's used for carry-out food, and it may actually have come from a restaurant called Time Out, which was an all-night restaurant near the Thrill. So it certainly could be very plausible that the girls stopped there for some food and went home. But anyway, there wasn't any blood on it, so the indication was it had been left after the attack on Faith.
Yes, and it seemed like if you look at the note, jealous was below the rest.
Right.
Chris, it was very sloppy, like it was written fast and messy. But I almost interpreted it as like, "I'm not stupid, comma, bitch," and then underneath, "jealous," with a question mark.
Right.
Which and seems like something another woman would write.
There's a bunch of interpretations of that.
That's true.
Yeah, and while handwriting experts think that the note was written by a woman, and they also think that the writer could have been using the non-dominant hand in order to disguise the writing.
Well, that was pretty good for a non-dominant hand, though. If I write with my left hand, it's not legible at all. It'd have to be someone who was a little bit ambidextrous.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Or you got to take your time writing it. Now, yeah. they looked at a sample of handwriting from Karina, and at least one expert said it wasn't her writing. And that was based mostly on how an E appeared in the note on the white paper bag and the restraining order against Eric Jones.
Yeah, that's true. They were significantly different, and it was obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, the expert, though, did think that the person who wrote it was, you know, in a state, was
yes.
in an emotionally unstable state of mind.
Absolutely.
But they decided they didn't think Karina wrote the note. And the question of what purpose this note was supposed to serve, you know, is just weird to me. I guess it's important because maybe it's just a red herring.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, if it's directed towards Faith, she's dead at this point. I mean, you don't need to leave a note.
Yeah, that's why it makes me think that maybe it was just set there to, you know, mislead people.
Possibly.
But if that's the case, it would have to be one of the women. Although I guess it could have been someone who was in the apartment, killed her, and then washed up and wrote the note. And that brings me back to the guy who lived in the same building. Because he wouldn't have had to leave the building. But also if someone left the building and they were washed up, they wouldn't leave footprints or any kind of blood on the way. So either way, it had to be someone, in my mind, who was comfortable there and didn't feel like anyone was going to be coming back and finding them anytime soon.
Yes, and that's an important point.
Yeah.
The other thing with Eric Jones, who looked really good, is that his DNA didn't match.
Yeah, the DNA is just really tough.
DNA is very problematic.
Yeah, it is. If there wasn't DNA, I would have some strong opinions.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Victoria, who is a good friend of Faith's, and again, the woman who is going to be sharing an apartment with her, got a voicemail from Faith at 1:23 in the morning, the night she died. Now, initially, Victoria thought it was just a pocket dial and deleted it. Then thought about it and said maybe this could be important, so she found a way to retrieve it. So we got this voicemail that's about 3 minutes long, and there were at least three voices conversing, and there's some music in the background.
This is a tough thing to make out.
It's very difficult.
The words are unintelligible. It does sound like two women.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can hear loud music. And you hear two women who sound like they're arguing.
You do?
Yeah.
Now, Crime Watch Daily is looking at this case, and they hired a forensic audiovisual expert named Arlo West. And his specialty is interpreting this kind of recording, the pocket dial.
Mm-hmm.
So West claims, and Faith's father is in agreement, that this is a recording of Faith's murder.
But isn't that impossible?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
So... Wes says you can hear Faith saying, "Let me go," and another female swearing at her in an angry voice. And Wes says there are at least two male voices heard. One is saying, I think she's dying. And he can also hear the names Eric and Rosie, which certainly could refer to Eric Jones and Karina Rosario. I guess a lot of people called Karina Rosie.
That's right, yeah.
Now, the biggest problem with this, you know, being a recording of the time of Faith's murder, is that the timestamp was 1:23 a.m.
Exactly.
And they were at the club dancing.
And it sounds like they could have been at the club, too.
Right. Wes said that this is due to a software issue with the type of phones that Faith and Victoria used. The difficulty, I mean, they looked at this pretty closely because it would be important, obviously. The phone company and the police have confirmed that 1:23 a.m. was the actual time the voicemail was sent.
So we kind of have to be pretty sure that this happened at the club.
It certainly seems that way. And like you said, if the first part of it is two women arguing, it could be Faith and Karina getting into it.
Yeah, a lot of people think they had a disagreement at the club.
Right.
Listening to the recording of the voicemail, it's really difficult, though, to pick up the words. So I'm not sure about the way people interpreted those words.
It is. When they were replaying it or playing it, if I wasn't reading the captioning, I would not be able at all to pick out words.
Well, one thing they did pick out that seems pretty clear is the sound of T-Pain's song Booty Work, which was actually something that was played constantly at the Thrill during this time period.
Yeah, so that would go along with it being at 1:23 in the morning when they're at the club.
Yeah.
The expert, West, says he doesn't hear anything like that. He doesn't hear any music. He didn't hear any booty work song, anything like was described. So, kind of a quandary there.
Well, what about the expert we saw on the Breaking Homicide episode on this case?
Yeah, his opinion is that it was simply a recording at the club.
Yes, that's what he thought. And it seemed like it to me. I mean, even though I can't make out the words, I can certainly hear loud music.
Yeah. Wes says, yeah, but there's no sound of glasses clinking or anything like that, or crowd noise, but I don't know. I think it's very difficult.
Yeah, it is really tough.
Okay, then in September 2016, on an episode of 2020, Chapel Hill Police released an image that was felt to be the likelihood of Faith's killer. And the image had been created by Parabon Laboratories, which is a genetic testing company.
So this was an image based on what someone with that DNA profile might look like.
Yeah, and Parabon's been in the news a lot lately because they were part of the company that helped find the Golden State Killer. And they're also associated with this TV show we've been watching called Genetic Detective.
Right, but this case is different because we're not talking about finding DNA and tracking it through a family tree of DNA.
Right, no, we have the DNA. But they're able to take a person's genotype, the DNA that is left behind, and create a phenotype, which is the physical appearance of the person.
Yeah. So, I don't think that's that strong, but that's just my opinion.
Well.
Because you don't know.
I think.
It'll give you the basics.
It can give you some things.
Right.
And depending on how much data you have in your database, it might be more important than not. But anyway, the suspect or the person of interest in Faith's murder is supposed to be Latino, olive-complected, dark hair, dark eyes. And as far as this case is concerned, who knows?
Right, because the men involved in this, they were all African-American, right? The ex-boyfriends?
Right.
What about Jordan McCrary? Was he African-American?
Yes.
Okay. So we really don't have a Latino guy who would be a suspect from the characters that have been interviewed or brought up.
No, we don't. So I don't know exactly where that would leave us.
So it's almost 8 years, like we said, since she was killed. There have been no arrests. Karina's been looked at a lot, though. A lot of people see her as the primary suspect, either acting alone or with another person. But how do you explain the semen, then?
Well, again, that's a problem.
It is.
But the argument is something like this, that Faith and Karina got into a verbal argument at the Thrill. And we're basing that on the voicemail that Victoria got. And it starts out with what sounds like two women arguing.
Okay, yeah.
So they leave the club separately, but drive home together. And once home, the thumps that were heard by the downstairs neighbor were indicative of the onset of the attack on Faith.
So if that was the case, that would mean that the text that Faith sent later actually wasn't sent by her.
Right. So those texts were not sent by Faith. They were sent from her phone, but not by her.
And remind me what those texts were.
Well, one was to Brandon, the off-and-on boyfriend or former boyfriend of Karina.
Right, the one that just kind of said, come on over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one was to Faith's boyfriend, Ty.
Yeah, now that's an interesting one to me.
Yeah.
Because he had texted her earlier and she hadn't responded. And then we heard from some other people that had known the two of them that he was actually very possessive. And if she hadn't responded to him, it's very likely he would have been angry.
Right. He would have followed up on it.
Well, there was actually one girl who had spent the night at the apartment at one point, and he came stomping in and pulled the covers off of her, thinking she was Faith, in a bit of a rage.
Right.
So the text that was sent from Faith's phone to him was pretty much saying how much she cared about him and wanted to be with him. But that's not what we're hearing from her friends or people that knew her.
Nope.
We're not hearing that that was it at all. She was pretty much done with him. So that makes him very suspicious. Then again, the DNA doesn't match him, so we're stuck.
Yeah. So the way around that is that the semen had been planted.
I know, but that seems so far-fetched to me.
Well, it does, because if you're going to go to the trouble of doing that, then you have to have the actual person touching things in the apartment.
Right, yeah.
So anyway, once Faith was dead, Karina was going to process or stage the scene. So she wrote the note on the white bag. She planted semen. Then the bedroom where the murder took place, which, again, is Karina's bedroom.
Which is a little weird. Why was she in Karina's bedroom?
Don't know.
Because Karina said she thought she was asleep when she left.
Yeah. I guess the only explanation is that Faith had been sleeping on a couch. But if Karina's going out, she says, go ahead and take my bed. I'm sleeping somewhere else.
Is that what she actually said, though?
No.
Okay.
We don't know.
Okay. So that's all stuff we don't know.
Nope. But here's the interesting stuff, and this is why I think that Karina's responsible. The murder room, the bedroom, is the only room where blood was found. So, and like we said, blood was all over the place. So if the person had come in, murdered Faith, and left, you would have been able, should have been able to find blood evidence in the other room, on the porch, on the steps, but there wasn't any.
Right. And then you've got that bag with no blood on it.
Right. So that's one thing. The other thing, who's going to know the door's unlocked? I mean, if you're trying to pin this on some random guy, how do you know he would find that door?
Well, that's the thing.
Plus, this apartment, this block of apartments was at the far end of the apartment complex. So any, again, random person coming in would have to drive a ways to get to Faith and Karina's apartment.
Well, and that's why Karina just, maybe she didn't do it, but it seems like she knows something.
Oh, I'm positive she does. Everyone, I think, is positive that Karina, at the very least, knows more than she's fessing up to.
And I feel like maybe there's more than one person involved here. Maybe it was Karina and a guy that we don't know.
Right. That's the problem.
But then we have this thing with Ty and the text that she supposedly wrote him, which no one thinks she did.
Nobody does.
No.
Karina's pretty much dropped out of sight and has refused all interviews, but apparently does remain in contact with the Chapel Hill Police Department.
So they think she's cooperative.
They figure she's cooperative.
Right.
Faith's father, Roland, says that she stopped taking his calls and she just doesn't respond to him.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would be difficult, right?
Right. The problem I have, okay, and maybe you have, is the semen.
Well, the semen's been the problem, yeah.
So they found the same DNA in other areas. So
touch DNA, right?
Doesn't say, it just says the DNA. So it would not have been likely that the semen was placed in her vagina or on her body alone. Then you want to know, well, where'd they find it? Did she have sexual intercourse? Was she raped? The autopsy showed no evidence of genital or anal trauma. So less likely she was raped. I guess not impossible. Could she have had consensual intercourse before she died?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Maybe she had sex with someone who then left, and then someone else killed her, somebody else altogether.
Yeah, but then I'm troubled or having difficulty saying why the DNA was, the same DNA was found in other areas.
Well, what if she had a guy come over who hung out and stuff, and they had sex, and then he left, and then either the roommate did it, or the roommate left, and someone else did it.
Yeah, I suppose. Time-wise, that's tough to do.
Yeah? What's the time set up here that would make that tough?
Well, Karina was there until 4:30 or so.
Yeah.
So that only leaves like an hour or so left of darkness until daylight. And I don't think anyone's going to come out in broad daylight and kill somebody.
Well, yeah, but if it's someone living in the same complex.
Could have been, but how do they know the door's unlocked?
That's another thing. I don't know. Because we don't know if they normally left the door unlocked. It didn't seem like that was the routine for them.
No.
But it wasn't the first time either.
No, it wasn't.
So that's a possibility. But I definitely think that Karina and Ty are the people we really need to look at.
Well, I think they need, if they haven't done it, I think they need to retest the DNA found there and be certain that it's the DNA they think it is.
Mm.
Well, that sounds elementary, but they've probably done it.
But. Yeah, but errors do happen, so it's something to consider.
Yeah.
But I just find the case for Karina being involved really compelling.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, what are some other ideas?
Well, the only other ideas are kind of far out. One idea I came up with is that Faith was killed by her high school boyfriend. And the only reason I say that is that we've seen a couple pictures of him or of who's supposed to be your boyfriend, and he looks Latino.
Okay, so this is just something you've...
Yeah, this is out of left field.
It's your hole. It's just in your head.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, but I'm sure they'd look at that. I would hope.
I would think.
I guess you can't assume anything, but I would hope they'd looked at that.
Well, that'd be one thing. And if you think that's weird, I have an even more bizarre idea.
Okay, let's hear it.
When I look at pictures of them, Faith and Karina kind of resemble each other.
Yeah.
About the same height, same hair. They look kind of alike. And I know, or we know, that Faith was killed in Karina's bedroom, in Karina's bed. So could the killer have somehow mistaken Faith for Karina?
Well, I don't think that's that wacky, because what if that's the case, and what if Karina knows who it is and she's protecting him?
Possibly.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of out of left field.
Yeah, I know, but it's the kind of case where you really have to think of everything.
Well, and it's an absolutely fascinating case.
It really is, yeah.
I would love to find out who did it.
Well, an interesting part of it for me is when you see family and friends being interviewed, it seems that Faith was the prettier, more bubbly one that was attracting more attention from people. And that makes me think of the note that says jealous.
Right.
And it makes me think of Karina.
See?
And when you see Karina and Faith together, there is some body language of Karina kind of clamping on to Faith, who seems like the more effervescent person that's more attractive to people.
Right, and Faith is kind of leaning away from her in some of the pictures we've looked at.
Right, plus Faith was planning to move in with someone else. Was there something else behind that?
I don't know. I mean, my interpretation was that Faith didn't want to live out of a suitcase and sleep on a couch. And if she was living with her friend Victoria, she'd have her own room.
Right, but if Karita and Faith were best friends. They could have gotten a different apartment together if she really wanted to be with Karina.
Sure.
What if she wanted to leave Karina and Karina was pissed off? I mean, the other thing is we have the two females arguing.
Well, we have what sounds like two females arguing.
Right. Well, it's definitely two females talking.
Yes, but we don't know who those two females are.
No, but we know that Faith was with Karina that night.
Yeah. I mean, the likelihood is that it was Faith and Karina arguing.
Yeah, so you have the note, which looks like it was written by a woman. You have the 911 call, which was really strange, which was Karina speaking. And then you have her dying in Karina's room, which makes me think either she was mistaken for her or she was in that room for a reason. They were arguing or something when it happened.
Yeah, you're right.
So, such a mystery. We watched that show Breaking Homicide about it, and what did they conclude? Because they really went through it in some pretty good detail. That was like an hour and a half episode, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And like many people, they feel that Karina is either the person who did it or she was involved. She definitely knows more than she says she knows.
Well, and they also interviewed Ty, who lied to them.
Yeah.
Told them a whole different story.
Well, yeah, you don't want to be the girlfriend abuser.
Well, sure, and his only alibi was that he was with another woman that night.
And his DNA doesn't match.
The DNA, that's what always catches you.
Yep.
So that's a real mystery. Well, I just hope that they're able to solve this for the family's sake. I mean, her parents definitely seem very devastated, as well as all her friends and family members. I mean, Marisol, who was with Karina, finding the body. And that's one reason why I find it hard to pin it on Karina also, is because Marisol was with her. And Marisol thought she acted pretty normal, you know, leading up to when they got there.
She did. But if you're a psychopath, you can do that.
That's true, yes. But I just hope for these family members that they figure it out.
Me too.
It's not going to bring her back. It's a terrible tragedy. Just really a sad case. And I just hope that they can solve that. Because it's also scary that the person who did this is still out there.
That's right.
But I can't see how it could be a random person.
Oh, it's very difficult to come up with it being a random
act. That'd be really difficult. It really seems like it has to be someone who knew her and that Karina knows something.
Yeah.
And maybe she knows something that the police know and it's just not something that's shared with the public.
Could be.
Possible that she's innocent, but there's just something there that hasn't been released to the rest of us to understand what happened.
That's right.
So, yes, definitely a fascinating case. And if anything else comes out about this, we'll keep everybody updated.
You bet. I'd like to be able to report that someone is brought to justice.
Absolutely.
So the sources for this episode, Breaking Homicide, Season 1, Episode 2, Who Killed Faith Hedgepeth? The ID Channel, Who Killed the Coed? ID Channel again, Faith Hedgepeth, The Missing Pieces. The Daily Tar Heel from October 25th, 2012, titled On the Last Day of Her Life, An Uncertain Timeline for Faith Danielle Hedgepeth. News and Observer, September 5th, 2014, titled Court Documents Unsealed in Search of Faith Hedgepeth's Killer. And then Crime Watch Daily, Investigating the Murder of Faith Hedgepeth, February 16th, 2016.
Okay, well, let's keep an eye on that and hope that it hasn't gone cold.
We'll keep a watch on it. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's wrap it up. And I just want to let everyone know that our part two on the Betty Broderick story will be coming out in a few days. And I hope you're enjoying those. Those were just a couple little extra bonus episodes we did for the pandemic, because we all have a little more time to kill than usual. And I hope everyone stays healthy and well until we see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll be there. Save you a seat.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.